ESPN 107.3 presents Wild at Heart, bringing outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, powered by Cowtown USA, Colton Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Shady Lanes Cabins and Motel, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, and State Farm agent Michelle Beckett. Now, here's Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome to Wild at Heart, right here on ESPN 107.3 FM in the Pulse of the Ozarks, beautiful Rolla, Missouri. Hi, I'm your host, Bill Cooper, member of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, and in the studio is Jerry Cook and also our great sound man, John Francis. Welcome to Wild at Heart. We're a bunch of red-blooded Americans who remember and cherish our outdoor heritage. We love America and we support the Second Amendment. We stand for our national anthem. Say please and thank you, and open doors for the ladies. We hunt, fish, trap, shoot, float, camp, and explore in God's country, right here in the Missouri Ozarks, which is right out your back door, and occasionally a few points beyond. Join us each week on Wednesdays at 4 p.m. here on Midmo ESPN 107.3 FM, or catch us Sundays at 8 a.m. or on ESPN107.3.com. This segment of Wild at Heart is brought to you by J. Cook Fly Rods. Custom fly rods plus everything you need for fly fishing, located in Salem, and Harvey's Alley Spring Canoe Rental, located on the crystal clear Jack's Fork River. Well, special guest today, Jerry, Mr. Jack Uxa from over the Lake of the Ozarks. Always enjoy talking to this guy.
Always an interesting guy to have on the program.
Hey, you know, I remember talking to him a year or two ago, and he told me he fished like over 300 days a year.
That's a lot of days on the water.
I'm a little bit jealous.
No kidding.
Jack, you on the line with us, buddy?
Yes, sir, I am. Yeah, I tell you what, fishing 300 days a year, not every day is as beautiful as it is right now, though.
Boy, I imagine that's true. I've been over with you when it was some pretty cool weather. But, you know, the neat thing is we always catch fish, or at least you do, you know, and I kind of pay attention, try to learn from you. In fact, it's been 3 or 4 years ago, you put me on to sight fishing for bass in early springtime. I wasn't really good at that. I probably don't have the eyes you have, but didn't take me long to catch on. And boy, did I have a good time the next day after I was with you.
Yeah, well, that's sight fishing, I tell you, it can be a challenge, you know. But I remember I had one particular customer this past spring that, you know, he hired me just to get tips for that, you know, and that's primarily what we did. And it's challenging, but I tell you what, just as with so many other things, you know, bow hunting or whatever, the more challenging it is when you finally get that fish to nose down and take that bait, and you rip into them on the hook set, it's awesome.
You know, it's exhilarating, man. But the hardest part about that was for me was just to realize what you were looking at, because quite often you just, you know, it's just a little difference in shade of darkness or lightness, that fish sitting on that nest in just a couple feet of water. But boy, once I figured it out, I was on to them. had a good time. Yeah,
and then you got to read your fish too, because not all fish are going to be receptive to what you're going to offer, and some fish are going to just take a lot longer than other ones, and then some of them aren't going to be worth messing with, and man, that's like so many things where time on the water and spending time with people, whether it's, you know, maybe the uncle that taught you how to fish, or, you know, your dad or a fishing guide like myself, you know, we could really make it a whole lot easier, because there's so many things where, well, you saw that tail shake in a funny manner, you know, and that means he's getting excited. And he did like a little body shiver thing. That's a good sign. That's a very good sign, you know, compared to, you know, he bolts as soon as you make a your lure enters the water, he bolts off. Well, that's a bad sign. And so there's so many little things like that. And you know, and sight fishing is just one of those examples of the details that come into play in this fishing and hunting, and you know, it's just it's all about the details.
It really is. And the guys that are death on detail, hey, they're catching the fish and killing the stuff out there, you know, because somehow they've paid attention to the detail over the years, and they've managed to store it away in their gray matter. And I get accused sometime, you know, of being able to remember that stuff quite well, but I can't remember to carry out the garbage.
I know there's been times where I can remember some fishing story from, you know, 20 years ago, and I caught him on this exact color, and I can tell you the exact stump, and, you know, all these kind of little details, and I can't remember to call somebody back or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I keep trying to convince my wife that I do, in fact, spend more time with fish than I do with garbage. So,
yeah,
sounds reasonable to me.
Makes sense.
It does. Well, Jack, just change subject here just a little bit. You come out of the summer now. Everybody's gone back to school. And are you getting to relax a little bit if things slow down?
Yeah, it's definitely slowed down. But unfortunately, I've been so backlogged with, you know, stuff. Right now I'm cleaning my boat literally as we do this conversation. I had a trip this morning, and it's a cool day, you know. I mean, Everybody's listening to this live, right?
Yeah, beautiful.
So, I mean, yeah, it's a beautiful, cool day here in, you know, for what's really mid-August. It feels like mid-September. And I've been doing a ton of catfishing the last month. Catfish are disgusting. They slime up all over the boat.
Yeah, but they're not disgusting when they're laying on a plate in front of you, and they're all golden brown.
Oh, no, that's when they're delicious. But I had a doctor's appointment. I've been having some work done, maintenance stuff, nothing big done to my boats. And so I haven't really had the opportunity to go hang any tree stands yet. But
I knew you'd get around to that.
Yeah, but it's coming. It's coming. I've got a pretty light schedule right now, too, for the next several days. And you're right, it's in between fall and summer, you know, because we don't have that summer crowd that we've had, you know, all through May, June, July, and most of August, or at least a good half of August. But it's not really fall yet, so I don't have my fall customers yet. You can't just expect to have a 78-degree day like it is right now in August. This is unusual. And it's always nice to see, like, a taste of the next weather, you know.
It is.
You know, wintertime, you start getting those spring-like days. And,
you bet.
You know, or even, I mean, honestly, I've got no problem with, cold weather. I kind of like fishing in the wintertime. I really do. And so when it's the fall and you start getting those really cold days, I know what that means for the fish, and I know where to catch them in the wintertime. And, me and you did a wintertime fishing trip, too, didn't we?
Yeah, and that's amazing. Last few years, I've learned a lot about winter fishing. I mean, all kinds of species. And I've run across a lot of young fellows like yourself that really hammer the water in the wintertime, and they catch the big largemouth. The guys in the rivers catch the big smallmouth. An old falconberry over at Truman catches the big blue catfish, and guys over at Stockton catch the big crappie and the
Well, the bottom walleye. Line is only the real fishermen are out in the cold weather. You know?
Hey, it's not crowded out there for sure. Yeah. That's the case for sure, man. But I'm glad you're getting a little bit of a break here. But did you have a good summer?
Yeah. Luckily, I've been doing this for a long time, so my summer is pretty much always the same. I mean, it's always pretty much lots of trips, and if I'm on the water, you know, if I'm on the water 6 days a week, that's a light week.
Wow. Jack, I've got a question here, and I haven't spent much time at Lake of the Ozarks in quite a few years, but are you dealing with any invasive species there yet, such as some of the mussels or other fish species?
Yes and no. I mean, there's definitely some Asian carp running around in here. I don't know what kind they are. They're not the kind that jump.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. I guess they're big heads or something like that. But you'll see them in the water every now and then. They got a big white mouth. And the bow fishermen really like to, shoot those things. But they don't really affect me. I do a lot of fishing. I do crappie, bass, catfish, white bass, gar. I don't do anything with the Asian carps. And I have been doing a lot of trips this year. In particular, this has been a really good year for the Osage River, right below Bagnell Dam.
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely a lot of Asian carp down there. and also zebra mussels. And
well, that was why I asked the question. I was wondering if they had made their way into the lake yet.
I know some of them are, but we're not seeing any of them jumping. So, I mean, I think that's where it's going to be a big deal. And I tell you what, those ones that are down below Bagnell Dam, they've actually been down there for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I remember seeing them jump up, and they just jump right into the concrete dam, and then they fall down, and then they do it again.
Yeah. I mean, hey, they jump in the boat, too. Those things will hurt you. I was up on the Missouri River 2 or 3 years ago by myself and looking for those fish and intending to film them, and I discovered rather quickly that the greener the water, the more Asian carp in it. So I went in behind a big island, and just immediately they started coming out of the water, and the first one come out of the water hit me right in the jaw, about a 20-pound fish. I thought he broke my jaw, and so I tucked the camera underneath the console and kind of hunkered down and tried to speed through them. I got 28 of those things in the boat in about 45 seconds.
Yeah, they have an issue with those things on the Mississippi as well.
Oh, big time, big time. And hopefully they'll come up with some commercial use. I know on the Illinois River there's a couple of companies that actually saying those things and make a food source out of them, and then awful is made into fertilizer.
Yeah,
But they're a problem. They've gotten into the Great Lakes now, and it all started in Arkansas with a farmer that had them in a pond for some reason, and of course had the floods, and out they went into the Arkansas River, I think, and then into the Mississippi. Once you hit the Mississippi, boy,
it's all over.
It's all over. Yeah,
weird is I'm friends with the guy that's a fish farmer here in Missouri, and he actually raises Asian carp. He has requests for me, and so he's a commercial farmer. You know, I mean, he sells the stuff.
Well, tell him he don't have to raise them; just go to the river, and he can let them. Hey, Jack, I hate to interrupt you here, but we got to take a short break here. Don't go away, man. We'll be right back and carry on the discussion. Hey, I'm Bill Cooper, and this is Wild at Heart. Stick with us if you're driving down the highway, and we'll see you in about 3 minutes.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart here on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment is brought to you by Cowtown USA, home of Can-Am ATVs and UTVs, and Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. It's not just land, it's a lifestyle, and we live it. On the other end of the line, we've got Lake of the Ozarks fishing guy, Jack Uxon. Jack's been at it for a good while, I guess. He still looks like a young man to me, but he claims he's been doing this for a long time, Jerry. But, Jack, man, we were talking about, before we went to the break, you know, the zebra mussels and the Asian carp and all that sort of thing. I'm glad to hear that they're not real bad in Lake of the Ozarks yet, but I've been out on the lake at night with some of the bow fishermen, and they kill a lot of gar and a lot of German carp, but I don't remember ever seeing an Asian carp myself, which is a good thing. But you know what? We don't want to spend all of our time talking about Asian carp when you don't even fish for those guys. Let's talk about the fish that you do fish for. And, of course, I know through the winter and the spring and the summer, you've done lots of crappie and bass, but is the lake changing now? The temperature is beginning to change. What's going to happen coming up in the fall?
Well, we still got a little bit of time before the big changes come around as far as water temperature. Usually September speaking, we'll definitely, and we're already starting to see some what I call late summer, early fall transition, okay? So what that means is bait fish are becoming very, very important. They're starting to move back in the coves. Now, they're not all the way in the back of the coves. They're not in 4 feet of water, but they're in about 10 to 15 feet of water, okay? And when your lake is 60 feet deep in most places, you know, that's relatively shallow.
Yes, it is.
Starting to move back there. About halfway, three quarters of the way back there is where they are right now. There's a few fish all the way in the back flats, in the back of the coves, particularly the big creeks. And if you're really good at sliding your baits underneath the docks, there's a few fish to be caught right there. But primarily, I've been concentrating on brush piles about three quarters of the way back in the cove. And
you probably know where they all are. How many waypoints you got marked? I mean, thousands.
A lot, yeah. I mean, honestly, I don't even have most of my spots marked because, I mean, you know, I might have one brush pile marked here, and that basically kind of reminds me of, hey, there's three or four brush piles in this area. But, yeah, I've got like 1,290 You know, and that's so many you can't even hardly keep them straight. It's basically just to remind you of, hey, there's a few things here in this area. There's a few things over in this cove. And, you know, this lake is so big. It's over 1,000, you know, miles of shoreline. It's just half the time we're not even fishing the shoreline. Half the time we're fishing docks or brush piles and, you know, offshore humps and points and stuff like that. It's a very large lake.
It is, and very, very diverse. It's always interesting trying to explain Lake of the Ozarks to somebody from out of state, or you're in their state fishing. You're trying to tell about Lake of the Ozarks, and particularly, you know, with all the buildings around it and that sort of thing. And I can remember the first few times I saw Lake of the Ozarks, I thought, man, I would never fish there, you know. Well, you know, I had to eat my words, because it's one of the finest crappie lakes you could ever hope to run into. And it's because of the structure that's there, all those boat docks and brush piles that people have been putting into the lake for decades and decades. And two, the food source, the food base that's available there, it's an unusual lake in that fact. I remember talking to Greg Stoner, I guess he's still the biologist over there for the lake, isn't he? Greg Stoner still around? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably 20, 30 years ago, maybe. I don't know. It's been a long time. I was doing an article for Missouri Game and Fish magazine and talked to Greg, and he was explaining that there's such a shad spawn there, and they grow so slowly that they stay, you know, an edible size for crappie for quite a long time. So crappie grow fast.
We've got a great crappie population.
Yeah.
And it's stable, too. You know, a lot of other places will be good for a few years, and then they're going to be bad for a few years, and then they're going to be good for a few years, and vice versa. And that's kind of normal for crappie, okay? But at Lake of the Ozarks, we're very fortunate to where we've got a very stable population of crappie. Year in, year out. And I tell you what, now we're using these bass crankbaits, and we're throwing them out the back behind the boat, and we're trolling. And, I mean, it's you know, kind of like a medium-sized bass crankbait, something like a wiggle wart size. I'm using the Flicker Sheds from Berkeley. Right. A lot of guys are using Bandit 300. Not what you would think would be a good crappie bait. And, well, we're trolling them, and it's working great.
Catching big crappie, then.
Yes, sir. Catching a lot of quality crappie, a lot of 11, 12 inchers. And, in fact, one of the problems we're running into is, what do you do with all these fish once you get them in your live well? Because, you know, water temperature is
I got a good idea.
It's called a fish fry.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's definitely, I've got, there's a veterans group here that asked me to donate some fish, and I've got a handful of fish I've got ready for them. In fact, I'm going to drop them off tomorrow, because this crappie bite has been so much fun here lately. You know, I've been getting into the spider rigging stuff, and I've been getting into trolling more and more since I've got the spider rigging set up for a bunch of, you know, essentially holding on to a bunch of rods, okay?
Yeah, yeah. Explain that a little bit. Some people will not know what spider rigging is. Sounds like a weird deal. Would you explain that to folks?
Well, it is a weird deal, okay?
right for once.
Yeah.
Yeah, traditionally speaking, what spider rigging is primarily designed for crappie fishing, where it's almost like trolling, except for that you're going out the front of your boat and you're not making a long cast. You're usually only going down, say, 8 to 15 feet. And instead of putting your rods in, you know, in your hand, you've got rod holders, and you've got 6 or 8 rods out in front of your boat. So the way I've got it set up is, I've got 3 rods to a person, I've got 2 seats in the front of my boat, and we slowly troll some open water. And we've got 2 hooks per rod, so we're pushing 12 minnows at a time. And it's just, I don't know, it's an unusual thing. I'm probably not describing it the best way, but it's a lot of fun when it works. And especially on those shallow lakes like Truman Lake and the dirtier lakes, that's where it really, really shines.
Yeah, I see a lot of that over there. So you're slowly trolling across the lake, and you've got several rods spread out across the front of the boat, essentially what you're doing. So you're concentrating a bunch of baits in one small area.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun, though. I tell you that. It's kind of boring in the fact that you never feel a bite. You never make a cast. You know, that's not, you know, that's not normal fishing. You know, that's kind of weird. I'm used to making a lot of casts, and if I don't feel the bite, I don't catch anything. Well, this is all about studying your rod tips and you know, having the right system in place to where it works. And it's surprisingly exciting because a lot of times when you get into them, it's really nothing too crazy to catch several fish, you know, in 20, 30 seconds. I mean, it can make crappie fishing a very exciting and quick way to catch them.
Well, I know it's effective, but when you get a bunch of fish on like that, do you wind up with a bunch of tangled lines?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. Yeah.
I can see that happening.
Yeah, and that's one of the nice things. And when I got my customers up in front, basically I'm the minnow dude. I'm what my job is to rehook minnows, you know, put minnows on a hook, untangle lines, measure fish, you know, put them in the live well. And it's basically a full-time job with those two guys watching the rod tips and swinging fish in, and then me unhooking the fish and putting them in the live well. It keeps us busy. I tell you what, it's pretty wild. And I don't do a whole lot of it. I mean, most of my crappie fishing is just rod and reel, single pole fishing is what the tournament guys call it, single pole.
Yeah.
And I do, but the spider ring has been something I'm getting more and more into, especially this past spring, and I look forward to doing it more and more this coming fall.
Hey, Jack, do those lines ever get tangled up in your trolling motor?
No, I've never had them get trolling motor, but what we'll run into issues with is like the catfish and some of the other species. You know, we'll catch some big bass doing it sometimes. And
well, that can foul things up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other day I went out just trying to figure it out as far as like this late summer pattern for them. And I went up in some shallow water up around PB1, which is, for those of you that don't know the Lake of the Ozarks very well, it's a very shallow, very remote part of the Lake of the Ozarks where there's not a lot of traffic. And there is a lot of bait fish, and there's a lot of, like, mud flats up there that are, say, you know, 8 feet deep with mm-hmm. an occasional stump or occasional log. And anyway, so I went up there. I already knew the bait fish were there because I've been bass fishing up there. And I started trolling the spider rigging, I should say. And I caught a few crappie. So, you know, but I was really catching more catfish than anything else, which, you know, it basically told me that I'm just a little early. I'm trying to get into this next phase, which is going to be a fall bite where the crappie are going to go a little shallower, okay? Well, they're not there yet, but those catfish are. Those catfish are up there, and they were tangling up the rods, and it was a workout because I was tuning by myself. But
you create a lot of work for yourself.
Yeah, but it's effective for a lot of different species, and people that just want to go out there and catch fish, and they don't care whether it's blue, green, gold, or whatever the fish is. It's awesome.
They just want to smell like a fish when
just
you come
so
back.
Just so it swims.
Yeah.
Well, boy. Yeah. Well, change subject just a little bit, Jack. Where do most of your clients come from?
Well, St. Louis is probably the single number one. But we get a lot of people from Iowa. A surprising number of people from Iowa come down here.
Really?
Particularly in the summer months. The spring and the fall is Kansas City and St. Louis. St. Louis is a little heavier. I mean, yeah, Kansas, Iowa, Illinois, Nebraska. I've had people from Alaska, Russia, various other countries overseas, Australia. I mean, just a little bit of everything. But St. Louis is probably the number one.
Well, you pull most of your clientele then from the Midwest. And, of course, I'm sure everybody in the Midwest have heard about the Lake of the Ozarks. It's been around for a long time. And, of course, there's the draw there. The tourist crowd likes to come in for the summer. And, of course, some of them stay away from the lake during the summer except for night fishing. And that's a fun thing, too. Do you get into the night fishing scene?
No, I don't. I'll do it every now and then. But
fish all day? You can't fish all night, too.
Yeah. Well, I do a lot of afternoon trips and evening trips, but I don't really do a lot of, like, traditional night fishing trips. You know, it's a busy lake, and even at night, there's some things that go on out here that you want to be able to very much aware of, and I'm sure that's true. People enough to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly in summertime, there's some big boats over there. You can get run over pretty easily, I think.
But, yeah, you got to come here with the right boat. If you come here with a little small boat, you better be very careful about where you go. You better be very selective and not try to do too much and go too far, because it could, there's some bad situations that can arise. In fact, this coming weekend, we've got one of the biggest boat races in the Midwest. It's called the Shootout. And
that sounds dangerous.
People coming from all over. Yeah.
Well, that's Lake of the Ozarks, man. But like I say, most of us that know Lake of the Ozarks, we don't fish it a lot during the summer unless it is a night. But, boy, you got all those other months all to yourself. Well, Jack, man, we're about out of time here once again. But how about you give your contact information right quick in case somebody wants to book a trip for this fall or winter?
Sure. Well, my website is fishinglakeoftheozarks.com. Okay, once again, that's fishinglakeoftheozarks.com. And my phone number is 573-434-2570. And give me a call on my cell phone, go to my website. I guess, you know, nowadays, yeah, everybody's got to have a Facebook account. I've got a Facebook account. I've got Jack's Guide Service Facebook. I got a bunch of pictures on there of what people have caught here in the last, you know, basically every week for the last several months. And, you know, you see what people are catching, what they're catching. Lately, it's been a bunch of catfish and some bass. You know, but that, man, back in the springtime, it was a bunch of crappie. I'm sure here, as soon as things get a little bit cooler, the crappie pictures will start showing up again.
I'm sure it'll be good, man. We encourage you to give Jack a call and hook up with him. Hey, man, we got to go to break here. But thanks for being on the show, Jack. Coming up segment three, Ray I will interview the legendary Babe Winkleman. You're listening to Wild at Heart. I'm Bill Cooper, and we'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
You can be sure they know what all this hard work is for. So now we honor you as legends, legends of the outdoors.
Yeah, the Legends Outdoors Hall of Fame song, Kevin Blake Weldon. What a guy. Hey, this is your handsome but yet humble host, Ray I. First, we want to welcome our great friend, Mr. Gary Mason, Legends of the Hall of Fame.
Thank you, Ray. Glad to be here, man.
Hey, we got a great guest coming up, don't we?
Boy, we do. The Hall of Fame. I've been watching this gentleman most of my life, and, you know, I've gone up to South Dakota and places like that and hunted, and this guy is just absolutely phenomenal. He is one of the heroes of the outdoors industry.
No question.
And just I'm
going to have to ask this guy really just how old he is, because I know he's been doing television over 30 years.
Yeah, but he must have started when he was like 12.
When he was 9. Hey, a little intro song for our guest.
Here we go.
Spend all day out on this lake, and hell is all I catch. But today she met me at the door, said I would have to choose. If I hit that fishing hole today, she'd be packing all her things and she'd be gone by noon. Well, I'm gonna miss her.
Better known to most people just as the Babe, isn't it?
The Babe.
The Babe? Hey, Babe Winkleman, welcome to Eyes on the Outdoors, my friend.
Well, thank you. And thank you guys for the unbelievable bunch of stuff you just made up about me.
Yeah, imagine that, Babe. Imagine we'd make something up about you. Before we go any further, congratulations, my friend, on being inducted into the Legends of the Outdoors Hall of Fame.
Oh, thank you so much, Ray. I am absolutely honored. I mean, it's not the reason a person goes about doing their life. You know, I mean, you do it for the reasons that you believe are what you should be doing. And it's just been an amazing 40-some years since I've been in the outdoors, full time at least.
You've done television forever, right?
A long time. I started with the Deep Woods Off insect commercials in 1978. And that drove me to start Good Fishing in 1980. And it's been a long time.
You've been a busy boy.
Well, I like being busy. I grew up in a farm milking cows, and we had cows, pigs, chickens, and grain crops. And, I mean, you worked every day, 7 days a week. That's just what it was. And I guess I've never known anything else but that.
Well, I got a question for you from a listener. They want to know what's your favorite fish
go fishing for?
The next one I'm catching.
That's a boy.
Somebody
I mean, you know, they're all good. And fishing is the most incredible sport because it offers something for everybody. One end of the spectrum are hardcore tournaments where you take your life in your hands. I remember fishing a BASS tournament down in Santee Cooper, South Carolina, where we got hit with a tornado. During the event, 22 boats were sunk. There was a station from Charleston watching the boats and the docks and everything just get wrapped up into a knot. And nobody got hurt. And I mean, these guys are as hard a core as exists. And then the next person can sit on a dock and on the lounge chair and get in a tan, have a beer in their hand, have a radio going, have a bobber out there. And if the bobber goes down, great. They'll catch your fish. And if it doesn't, well, they're just enjoying being there and smelling the outdoors and feeling the outdoors and hearing the sounds. And both of them are as successful as they can be. That's what's so cool about fishing. You can take it any way you want to as a person, and it can provide you what you're looking for.
So
it's nice, really nice.
You know, we're going to have a great time. I know that it's for most of our inductees, they wonder, well, what in the world is going to happen, you know, the day I go down there and go into the Hall of Fame. But it's just like a big family reunion, and we can't wait to have you down and share your wonderful career, because you know, your career has been as long as anyone's in the outdoors industry. You're one of the most well-known outdoor celebrities, and I know most of us don't use the celebrity word, but you are that to all the rest of us and all of us that look up to you. And you know, our tagline for Legends of the Outdoors is following in the footsteps, and you set the guidelines and standards for a lot of us to follow in your footsteps. And I just want you to know from the bottom of my heart how much I appreciate all you've done. And, you know, a lot of our guys don't realize they're doing stuff for others as they're trying to make a living in this industry, but you do each and every day. You open doors and for other people, and thank you for what you've done.
Hey. Well, thank you so much, Gary. We've always looked at it that our show was to be a service to the people in the audience. You know, so when we first started with television, I kind of got pushed into it. I didn't think I was smart enough to know what the audience wanted. So we always left a way where they could contact us or me. And I would write them a letter and say, guys, I need your help. I want to build the best show by your opinion that can do the most amount of good by your opinion. Please tell me. What do you like? What don't you like? Et cetera, et cetera. And we developed a questionnaire and I mean, at one time we had 150-some questions on a questionnaire, and guys would not only fill it out, but, I mean, they'd write 6, 8, 10 pages of notes in addition to it with thoughts and ideas. And for the last 37 years, we have molded and shaped their show and reshaped it every year for where the audience is at, because it is a service to them. Our goal is one thing. We want to inspire families to spend more time together in the outdoors.
Absolutely.
Fishing, amen. Hunting, being there.
Yep.
Absolutely. You know, Cuz Strickland was our guest speaker last year. Cuz said something that I'd never really thought about, but it rings so true, and especially with you, is our leaders in the outdoors industry didn't go by roadmaps.
Right.
We all set our own trails and made our own paths, and you have certainly done that in what you've done with your outdoor television programming and other things that you've done in your career. And I just thought that was so fitting for all of us that's been in the industry a long time. Ray, I too. Each one of us has we've blazed our own trails, and we've welcomed others to follow and to get on our train and ride with us. But what a wonderful, wonderful country that we live in, that we're able to do something that we enjoy doing and see God's face in the outdoors every day.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that 100%. On the other hand, I mean, those of us who pioneered the industry have to remember what happened to a lot of the pioneers who pioneered their country, where they wound up with arrows in their back. I mean, you don't always do everything right when you're pioneering, because there's nobody to ask.
You're right.
You've got to look up above and ask for guidance and help from our Creator, and then go about every day trying to do the best job that you can. And in our particular case, it's our best job is helping people understand the outdoors so they can have a little bit more success, have a little bit more fun, and inspiring to take their family along. I mean, when you go to your grave, it doesn't matter how big or small your pile is or if you have one.
Right.
The thing that amount or is the most valuable thing you have is your treasure trove of memories. And those that were the closest to your heart are generally family memories. The second ones, the most intimate memories, will be those that you make in the outdoors. And when you combine those outdoor memories with the family memories, you get what I have. A remembrance of my father. I took him to about every big thing he killed and every big thing he caught after I got started in the outdoor business. We spent so much time together. We had so many memories. We had so many things we did and were challenged at the same time. And, I mean, when Dad passed, there was nothing else he could give me. He had given me everything, including the inside of his soul, when we were out on a lot of these trips together. It doesn't get any better than that.
No, it doesn't. Babe, congratulations again. I'm going to see you down in Nashville.
Thank you, babe, and congratulations again. Yep. Can't wait to see you, man.
And thank you for coming on the show with us this morning. It was great to have you back on the show with us, babe.
Thank you, Ray. You guys have a great morning, and thank you for everything you do, Ray, to do exactly what I'm trying to do, inspiring more people to participate.
Yes, indeed.
It's as good of a thing as a human can do.
Amen. Great weekend, my friend.
Amen.
We need to take a break. We're going to stand aside and go to the other side.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source of information about what's going on in the world of outdoor recreation in the Ozarks and points beyond. This segment of our show is brought to you by Shady Lane Cabins and Motel in Eminence, offering you a comfortable night's sleep after a long day on the river. Remember, you can always listen to Wild at Heart anytime you want at our website, ESPN1073.com. Just click Programming and Wild at Heart. Or ask Alexa to play the Wild at Heart podcast from TuneIn Radio. She'll be happy to play last week's show for you. What a deal, Alexa.
Yeah, I hope you get along with Alexa better than I do.
Well, I have a granddaughter. We call her Alexa, so I get along really well with her, but I don't know about this gal.
Well, I can tell you it's difficult.
Now, that's probably just, you're just not in tune with things, Jerry. You got that disability called old age.
Yeah, you're probably correct about that as well.
Hey, get one of your grandkids to help you.
And they would probably know more about setting it up than I do.
Well, Jerry, we're going to kick some outdoor topics around during this segment. And one of the things we want to discuss, and just came across the news wires yesterday or the day before, and that's the possibility of having an elk season in Missouri in 2020. That's just 2 years away.
Yes, it is. And, you know, I think that's exciting, really.
Oh, I do, too. And, boy, if you've been down to Eminence at all, and starting about this time of year, you know, the bulls start to bugle. And I tell you, you talk about something that'll make the hair stand up on the back of your neck.
Oh, yeah. I've listened to them down in Arkansas as well and actually seen them running through the fields and so on. It's exciting.
It is. They're such a majestic animal.
They are.
If you've never seen a bull elk before and you get up close to one, it's just flabbergasting how big those things are.
They're really big. They've got a big rack on them. And, of course, as you know, on some of my custom fly rods, I use Elkhorn reel seat inserts. And
exactly. You're not the guy poaching the elk down
no.
there. No. Peg Ranch.
No.
Yeah, they had a problem.
Not for what I pay for that stuff.
Yeah. Had a problem a year or so ago. And I don't think they ever found the guy that killed the bull elk. I think just took the head was a sad thing about it.
But, yeah. What a waste of meat.
Yeah, and there's been some huge rewards out for that person, but I don't think they ever caught him. But, folks, if you've never seen or heard elk, good idea is check with Mayor of Eminence, Jim Anderson. He advertises with us as the Shady Lane Motel. He is a wealth of information, and we need to have him on the show again before the middle of September, and he can tell us all about it. But if you're in Eminence, stop by and talk to Jim. He's the tourism ambassador of Eminence, Missouri. They're very lucky to have that man because
he's the man down there.
Hey, very knowledgeable, but he not only can tell you about the elk, he can tell you where the wild horse herds are. I mean, he's out looking for them all the time, or people are reporting to him. And they're a cool animal to see as well.
They're beautiful.
Yeah. Where else in the state can you find elk?
usually captive.
Don't mean to put you on the spot here.
No. Captive breeds. The next closest place is St. Louis County Parks.
Lone Elk Park,
exactly.
Okay. But down in Eminence, they're wild, right?
Yes. They were brought in, I think, from Pennsylvania. Am I correct, Jerry?
I'm not sure where they were brought
Tennessee.
In from. Maybe Tennessee. Yeah, they were brought in, though, and stopped down there.
Yeah, Land Between the Lakes has had a elk herd for a long time. I remember when I was superintendent of Merrimack Spring Park back in the early 70s. I actually made a week-long trip over there. It was park business, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
over the Land Between the Lakes, and I got to talk to the biologist over there, which was so interesting because they had the elk. And I was a little more fascinated by the buffalo they had. Now, there's a big creature as well. And you can see buffalo at Lone Elk Park, too. So
that land between the lakes area, of course, as you know, that's where I grew up, down in Paducah and Kentucky Lake area. And, of course, Kentucky has an elk season now.
Yeah, they have had for quite some time, I guess. But that Land Between the Lakes area runs from Kentucky down into Tennessee.
To Dover, Tennessee. Correct.
Yeah, and so interesting talking about the buffalo, though. They're such a big, strong animal. And the biologist said, yeah, I know about that very well because we have to actually thin those herds occasionally. And he said, first time I attempted thinning the buffalo herd, it was a real fiasco. He said, you know, I figured I'm just going to shoot this thing in the head with a .30-06, a big old bull, and that's going to be the end of him. He said, I guess that bullet bounced off of his skull, and he stood and shook his head for a minute or so, probably rung his bells pretty good, but he took off running and ran through every fence they had. They were 4 days catching this dude, you know, and of course all the rest of them got out when he broke the fences down. And he said, after that, I got a bison skull and studied it to the nth degree, you know, and found the weakest spots. And he said, I did a lot better on my second attempt. But they are a big animal. But elk, yeah. And you know, it's great fun to go out west. I've been out there elk hunting several times. And to hear an elk bugle way out through the mountains and hear that sound echo through those mountains.
Just something about it, isn't there?
Wow. I tell you what, it makes every hair on your body stand up, man, because it's just, and it's a weird sound coming from such a large animal, you know, and you hear the cows whistle, and a lot of the guys that turkey hunt, they say it's no different turkey hunting. You do basically the same thing, and they react much the same, you know. You call them, they bugle, the turkeys gobble. Hopefully they're coming closer. You try to move closer as you can. And particularly with elk hunting, I know we were bow hunting one year out in the way southwest Colorado, and a friend of mine, two of them went out together, and they got on an elk. Well, they were trying to be nice to each other. The bull was coming, but to get a shot, they needed to move, and neither one to move because he's trying to be nice to their buddy, and they let the bull get away, you know.
And, you know, southwest Colorado, some nice mountains there, some beautiful country, and
it's a big mountains. I know we were the person with me, we'd gone way off down a mountain, and it's 96 degrees, and we had shot opportunities very first day we were there, and we herded this little herd of bulls and cows around. We split up, and I had six or eight good shots, but literally didn't take a shot because it was so hot. I was afraid the meat would actually spoil before we could get off of that mountain. So you got to think about the terrain and everything else out there. But, you know, we're talking about the Missouri Ozarks. There's some pretty big hills down at Peck Ranch. That's where this first elk hunt will take place for sure. And I'm sure it's going to be a very limited sort of hunt. How many tens of thousands of people do you think will apply for those few permits?
I was going to say there'll probably be a very few permits and thousands of people applying for them.
Thousands and thousands. But I hope they give the old guys a break, you know. And if when I fill out my application for that hunt, I'm going to put on there older than dirt. That's what my kids always tell me. You think it'll gain me any advantage, John?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
Well, I'm going to try it anyway.
Might as well try.
Yeah. At least make them laugh and get in a good mood,
sure.
You know.
All they can do is say no.
Well, yeah. Well, we all know it's a lottery draw. We know all about the lottery. Only time I ever won was the first military lottery. They had, Trick.
Yeah, greetings from the president.
yeah. The joke was on me, man. But it is excited. I know Dave Mace from down at Salem is on the head of the elk committee, I think, for the Conservation Federation of Missouri. And, of course, he's been an elk hunter for decades, goes out west a lot, knows a lot about elk, and I'm sure has had a great deal of influence on the direction this whole program has gone.
Mm-hmm.
Great guy, and he knows a lot of elk hunters, too. He got some buddies from Salem. I think they probably go elk hunting every year, you know.
Well, there's an elk Federation?
Yeah, Rocky Mountain.
Yeah, right.
Elk Foundation.
Yeah, there's a chapter here locally.
Yeah, and they have some great events, too, and I guarantee you these guys are up on what's going on.
You know it.
with the herd down there. So, hey, it'd be another way to find out. Maybe aim buddy up with somebody a little bit that knows a little bit about elk hunting, because, you know, that's always a great deal of it's just an advantage when you can hook up with somebody that's got decades of experience under their belt.
Right.
You know, it's just like your fly fishing situation. You know, people can talk to you about fly fishing and cut light years off of the learning curve, you know. I've learned to do that as an outdoor communicator. You hook up with people that know what they're talking about, you know.
Network.
Absolutely. Just like Jack Oxo we just had on, he taught me so much about bass fishing, and I thought I knew a lot about bass fishing. But, hey, and jump the subject, talking about bass fishing, you know, I've just made a trip over to Stockton Lake again with Chris Nelson over there, took Damon Spurgeon with me. It was his idea. He got us into this, you know. And not that I can blame him, because Chris and his cousin, I guess, Boyd was his last name, but boy, they got us on the crappie, and we were catching crappie. And another rainy, blowy, nasty day. That seems to be when I go, you know. But man, you're catching fish; it doesn't bother you too much, you know.
It tends to warm things up a bit, doesn't it?
It really does. And you know what? About noon, I'll never forget as long as I live, Jerry. There was about 3 acres of white bass blew up on top of the water chasing bait fish, and we caught fish like crazy. And those guys are saying, "Why didn't we bring our fly rods?"
Uh-huh.
And they're wanting to do a show, film a show on fly fishing for white bass at Stockton Lake. It'd be very easy to do. Man, Jerry, boy, our time just flying by.
It just flies.
Hey, we're talking about our favorite subjects. That's why.
Absolutely.
We can talk about it for hours and hours on end, I think. But you know what? We have to take a break once in a while. But, hey, stay alert about that elk season 2020. Try to follow that and get your application in. If you get a chance to go bass fishing, white bass fishing, crappie fishing over at Stockton Lake, Lake of the Ozarks. Got a lot of good fisheries here in the state of Missouri, and we're extremely fortunate to have such places to go. But again, the Missouri Department of Conservation, Conservation Federation of Missouri, are largely responsible for those fisheries, and hey, we just do our part, Jerry.
Absolutely, and we've got one of the best conservation departments in the country.
We certainly do. Hey, don't go away, folks. If you're driving down the highway or just getting home, stay with us. I'm Bill Cooper on Wild at Heart.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart. This segment of our show is brought to you by Advanced Performance Shooting in Waynesville, offering classes on firearms use and safety. With me in this segment is Jimmy Traylor, one of my favorite people down there in the great state of Arkansas, from Wishes and Fishes Fly Shop. Jim, how's everything going down there?
Man, it's like air conditioning outside as of this morning, Jerry. You guys probably got it too, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful day here. It would have been a much better day to have been spent on the river than where I was. So, how's the fishing?
Stuck in your shop? I was stuck in my shop today.
No, I had a little visit with the VA today, you know, so, you know, one of those things. But it would have been a whole lot more fun on the river.
Ooh. No, our fishing down here has been pretty good. Our sulfur hatch, you know, mayflies have been going pretty good. It's starting to wane, so we're on the waning side of that. But you know, we've always got midges, so that keeps things exciting.
ruby midges, root beer midges.
Yeah, yeah, those styles of midges that you mentioned, they work well up in this area as well. It's been a good hopper season up here too. How about in your area?
It's a good hopper gig on this river is two units of water, and we haven't really been getting that until later in the day.
Uh-huh.
Although on a little bit of rising water late in the day, some purple bottom, tan bottom, I've had a little luck on stimulators. Pink bottom hoppers have been doing pretty good.
Yeah, tan hoppers and Fat Albert patterns have been doing well up here. Just something about that tan color. I can't explain it. But they've been doing well. And, of course, we've talked about this before. I think I like to do a hopper-dropper set up in this area.
I'll do some ants with a dropper on the minimum flow.
Uh-huh.
Although I'm thinking about doing some miniature articulated streamers. How do you like that, Bill?
You just had to get that in there, didn't you?
Yeah, size 14 articulated streamers, two of them together.
Yeah, yeah, well, the articulated that I fish up here are number 6 front, number 8 stinger hook, and I've never tried doing a dropper off of them, though.
That probably wouldn't work.
No, I wouldn't think so. I think it would kind of hinder the tail action on that streamer, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. we need a little bit of flow for those hoppers to kind of work. That or some wind.
Yeah.
And in the past few years we've sort of got that. This year we have more of a normal lake elevation. We don't have all the water and rain. Well, you guys dealt with it too. I mean,
yeah.
We get your water, so.
Well, we've had some hard rains up here at various times. It's not a slow soaking rain. It's just a downpour.
Ooh, we've been getting some slow soaking rains down here. It's kind of nice for a change.
Well, yeah, it would be. We could use the same thing here. But, boy, when it rains hard. And, it just runs off and ends up in your area.
Well, that's true eventually. But our lake hasn't really come up. It's still dropping.
So...
it's fine. We could use another couple of foot in it, to be honest.
So has minimum flow been affecting your fishing there much, or is it?
It's made it good for small stuff, hence the size 14 articulated streamers. Anyway, throwing small stuff and. The other day I was out, man, they would swim up to the midges and then swim away. And as you pulled it away, they would chase it.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, now's probably a pretty good time to put a little minnow on or something. So we did that and started catching fish in black.
No kidding.
Wouldn't do it in brown. Wouldn't do it in olive. Wouldn't do it in yellow. Wouldn't do it in gray, but black.
I'll be darned.
The better.
And white woolly boogers, which, of course, look like a bait fish to the trout, seem to work well up here, and in olive as well.
Right. Well, I tried those, and the only thing that would work was black.
No kidding. Now that
you'll figure.
I can't, I mean, that's why they call it fishing, isn't it?
Well, that's right. We just try to turn it into catching. That's all we try to do.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, we had that a year ago after the floods here. You go down on the current river, it wasn't fishing. It was catching. It was just incredible. I've never had a day like that in my life and probably never will again, Jim.
Oh, don't say that now.
Well, it was so good, even I could catch fish.
Now, was it that bad, Bill?
Well, I tell you what, the biggest problem you had, there were just thousands. I guess they lost the whole hatchery.
They lost 750,000 fish out of the hatchery.
Yeah, a lot, tons of fish. Biggest problem you had was trying to get a fly past all those 5-inchers, to get down to the bigger fish. But once you did, it was worth the effort.
Holy cow.
Yeah, wow. It was incredible, Jim.
Are you talking about the Neosho hatchery? Which hatchery are you talking about?
No, the one at Montauk State Park.
Okay.
Yeah, they lost a ton of fish. It was interesting to watch the people that wanted to catch fish to take home. I literally watched lots of old men one morning. They were allowed four fish each. They made four casts, and some of them caught their four fish in less than 2 minutes. You know, and went home.
Yeah, you guys got that rain worse than we did down here. Well, now we had to deal with the after effects after you got the rain, but
yeah,
we didn't have houses washed off of our river like you did on the North Fork or some of those.
Oh, the North Fork really got clobbered.
Disappeared.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. In fact, I was in a turkey hunting camp on North Fork when all of that hit. They're close to Dora, Missouri, and there were four bridges that went out within 20 miles. We had a tough time getting out of that part of the country. It was devastating, the worst it ever hit that part of the country, for sure. Changed the fishery down there, too.
Well, I bet it did.
Yeah, it changed the whole current river up here. I don't know really how much it affected some of the other rivers in our area, but the current river especially, where there were no holes, there were holes. Where there had been holes, there were no holes. It just changed the whole complexion of that river, Jim.
Yeah, if you're going to go fish, it wasn't the same river you're fishing. Most of these rivers were that way, and you literally had to relearn the river. Just you had to spend the time on the water to figure things out again.
Right.
Jim, a question that came up earlier when we were talking to a bass fisherman on Lake of the Ozarks, and I was kind of wondering that about your area down there, too. Where do most of your clients come from?
You know, it kind of right now they're coming out of mostly Texas, Oklahoma, but that, you know, it's back to school. But we get them out of St. Louis, Tulsa, Springfield, Memphis, Kansas City. You know, the surrounding states. Chicago's pretty big. Dallas, Houston, Oklahoma City. Mississippi, Jackson, not so much along the Gulf Coast, New Orleans a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 500, 600, 700 mile radius, pretty much.
So you pull from a pretty wide area then. Do you get many clients from out of the country down there?
You know, we used to. We don't get quite as many anymore like we used to, it seems like. We used to get a bunch from Japan, the UK.
Uh-huh.
You know, Saturday I fished a guy from Chile and a guy from Brazil, you know.
I'll be darned. I've had guys in my shop from Australia and from Germany, but don't see too many people from outside the country in our area. I was just really curious if you did on the White River system because it's so well known these days.
Yeah, you know, the dollar's up. The euro's down.
Yeah.
You know, so the exchange rate's probably not. So, you know, we see a fair amount of Brits, I guess.
You know.
But here lately, just not a lot, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, that exchange rate, a lot of people would have no idea how much that affects that type of business.
Oh. Well, it can turn a. I mean, it can turn $100. You know, you buy something for $100, it can turn it into $120 or $125.
Yeah, exactly. And I ship a lot of stuff to the UK, and when that exchange rate is out of kilter, so to speak, it affects my business to the UK.
Yeah, and that's the pound, and the pound is, you know, the pound has suffered even more than the euro has.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, it'll do that.
Well, I tell you what, this fly fishing, it's a global thing, and a lot of people in who aren't really into this, as we are, don't realize how much of it is done in places like Australia, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and as well as in this
Finland,
country.
Sweden, Norway,
yeah.
The Russian Federation,
exactly.
I mean, the U.S. youth. The U.S. youth team just spent, you know, they just got back from Poland.
Yeah.
You know, the Czech Republic, Greece, Turkey, all the stans along there. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the fly fishing, the Japanese, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's the New Zealanders. Oh, yeah, it's huge. And then you start talking about saltwater.
Right. So, hey, Jim, this segment's gone already, man. We've got to go pay some bills. But hang in there, guy, and we will be right back with Jim Traylor from Wishes and Fishes Fly Shop in Bull Shoals or Lakeview, Arkansas.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3 FM. This segment of our show is brought to you by Colton Steakhouse and Grill in Rolla, where we know what's at stake. Also by Trout & Sons, serving you with boats, motors, trailers, and accessories since 1972. Located on County Road 1000 in St. James. It's always fun at Trout & Sons. Welcome back, Jim Traylor.
Well, I appreciate it, Mr. Jerry and Mr. Bill. I hope y'all are having fun up there in Missouri, because we're having fun down here in Arkansas.
We always have fun here in Missouri. Hey, Jim, tell us something here. Tell us a little bit about your business there. First of all, we know you as a guide, but there you have other things going on in your shop there as well.
I am a tying shop, Jerry. I don't carry apparel. I carry some caps and T-shirts from time to time. But I've got thread, I carry tying stuff. I carry terminal tackle. I carry tungsten beads.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Holy cow. I've been selling tungsten beads for 16 years, importing them directly, and then basically my price is less than the wholesale of the... I could name some names, but I won't.
Right. That's probably a good thing you don't.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't do that. You know, I do them in 100 packs and 25 packs. And as a matter of fact, this is the second year in a row I've done this, 20% off if you go on to theflyfishing-store.com. And at checkout, enter 20% off everything, all caps. You get 20% off my tungsten beads, which are less than the wholesale of the big guys.
Wow, that's a pretty darn good deal.
You can't beat that.
No, you can't. That's a hard deal to beat. And also, I know you know how to buy thread trays, too.
Yes, I do. Well, I know how to buy one.
Yeah.
The second two I bought weren't cheap.
You know I'm not going to let you live that one down, don't you?
I think you need to tell that story, okay, Jerry.
That's a long story, but I had somebody doing my bidding for me, and Jimmy caught on to that real quick.
Hey, my situational awareness is pretty good. After all, I'm a top-notch guy. I'm a second-tier guide.
Yeah, I'd have to say it's pretty darn good, because, like I said, it didn't take long for you to catch on to that one. I knew if you saw me running over to bid, you'd catch on real fast, so I sent my buddy Mike over, and you caught on just about as quickly.
Well, when you were when you had your back turned and you were trying to sell a reel or a rod or something, that's when I moseyed on over.
Yeah, I know. I know. Hey, I understand you're also importing hooks now.
I'm going to start doing it. Yeah, I've got them. I'm going to start bringing in. They're extremely similar to the actually, they're from the same manufacturer as the company, are they in Montana, the Firehole? Oh, I probably shouldn't say that either, but anyway. Yeah, they're a barbless hook, black nickel coated, perfect for fly tying and fly fishing.
Yeah, it sounds to me like it's from the same company.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. It'll be a good thing. I'm going to do them the same way in boxes of 50. I'm gonna brand them Hogskin Creek. I've got a buddy of mine who actually he's in the business of doing logos for one of the larger boat companies in our area.
And who would that happen to be?
Starts with an R and ends with an R.
Uh-huh.
He's put together a quick logo for me, since that's what he does for a living.
Yeah.
So it should work out pretty good.
Yeah.
And
those,
I'm going to do. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Those connections always help, don't they?
Oh, absolutely.
As I've said for a long time, networking, there's nothing like it.
Yes.
I just want to keep a lot of people in business. I'd like to ask you a question. I'm not much of a fly tire, and maybe this will help explain some things to some people. I know you and Jerry know all about it, been doing it for decades probably. You were probably born with a fly thread in your hands, you know. But talking about tungsten beads, now, what's the advantage of using tungsten beads when you're tying flies? What are they for? And what's the advantage? I know we talk about tungsten shot. I'm a waterfowl hunter, you know, and I understand it from that perspective. But when it comes to fly tying, what's the tungsten beads all about?
So you understand? Well, it used to be in fly tying, you could get a bead that was made of brass.
Right. I have
and
some.
You could get it in. Yeah, you could get it in a few colors.
Uh huh.
20 years ago. 30 years ago.
And today,
the tungsten bead is twice as heavy as the brass bead.
Okay.
You could get lead beads, but they're soft, and they wouldn't hold paint. A tungsten bead takes 6,500 degrees to melt it, and its qualities are a little more like glass than they are metal.
Exactly. Gotcha.
If that makes any sense. So
yeah,
it's denser.
Yeah, yeah.
And I assume
you can get it in a lot more colors as well.
Oh, yeah. It comes in lots of colors. Yeah.
Gotcha.
But so does the brass today, too. And a lot of folks are going back to the brass because the tungsten sinks too quick. They want something that sinks a little slower. And people have become extremely creative with brass and tungsten beads, or just beads. Just in the last 10 years, people have become so much more creative with tying flies. It boggles and blows my mind.
Oh, I tell you what, Jim. I have people in my shop that it just, you know... It's just amazing some of the things that they come up with, and you get them talking about what their favorite pattern is and how they tie it, and it's just amazing some of the twist on some of the old patterns that there are out there now.
Well, Jerry, I'm sure you fish flies with the tungsten heads on them.
Yes.
What's your favorite fly with a tungsten head on it?
Well, I like midges myself. Yeah, Jim mentioned the Ruby 2 midge. That's a good one. There's also a purple version of that that's a really good pattern up in this area. But zebra midges, different midge styles or colors, I really like with a tungsten bead.
Makes sense. And I'm sure I've got some of them in my 25 fly boxes somewhere, you know, and I have fished them. And I remember using black on some flies and doing rather well.
Yeah, I like black beads as well, and I'm sure you probably sell a lot of those, don't you, Jim?
Oh, yeah, I absolutely. My favorite midge is the one that catches fish. But.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, whichever color they're biting that day. And I think you listed them all, you know, red or black, purple. Purple's the, you know, a while back, purple was the new black.
Yes.
And woolly boogers and midges and articulated streamers.
Bad word.
Bad word. Especially if they got barbs on them and they're in your ear.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Chuck and duck, right?
Yep, chuck and duck.
But, you said that tongue-in-cheek there, but, whatever's catching fish that day, that's the hot pattern, and that's your favorite pattern. But, you know, there's all kinds of different colors and of midges that you can tie, and then when you counter-wrap them with copper wire, silver wire, gold wire, it changes them all together again.
It's amazing. I know you're familiar with it's the pearl tinsel.
Yes, uh-huh.
I mean, you can put a color thread down and then lay the pearl tinsel on top of it, which looks like it's white on the spool.
Right.
And if you put red thread down, it might turn green. Mm-hmm. Or, I know if you do, we tie a pearl bidge, you put black thread down and a green peacock body, and the thing looks green.
Yeah.
You know, go figure.
Yeah.
You can put brown thread on it, and it looks red. You know, I mean, it's incredible. Some of the synthetic stuff that's out today is just it's never ending.
It's really mind boggling what some of the synthetics will do, and yet our old buddy up here, Mark Van Patten, says there's nothing like natural materials, and to a degree I agree with that. But then when you start pulling out some of these synthetic materials, and what they will do, and the colors that evolve out of some of the combinations, it's pretty amazing.
Well, Jim, I got a question, too. We're talking about all these colors and all these materials that are available to fly tires today, and I know there's new creations coming up all this time, but how do you turn that over, you know, to the fish? Are they responding to all these new patterns? I mean, are they eating things they've never seen before? I mean, do they work is what I'm asking.
You know, some days the kitchen sink fly will work.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you throw at them, it'll work. You know, the next day, maybe it's a full moon and they want something really tiny. They want something really natural. They don't want a bead on it. You know, maybe you have to split shot it. I mean, it has to, you know, maybe you have to use 8X tippet. You know, you got to take your indicator off. Or you put your indicator on, pull it off, and the residue is your indicator.
I mean, right, right. It's just amazing sometimes. And as I always say, Jim, a lot of times I think it's just throwing them something they've never seen before.
Well, I tell you, see that answer? Now, that's the epitome of
Absolutely.
Fly fishermen. They're secretive and evade the question. You know, hey, Jim, man, it's been great having you on the show. We're coming up on wrap-up time here, man. Great information. Always a pleasure to have you on. So, folks, it's about break time here once again. We're coming up on the last two segments already. This show has flown by.
It has. Really gone by.
We usually have Tommy Bench on, but he's had a medical emergency in the family and can't make it this evening. So Jerry and I are going to wing it here for the last two segments. We got a lot of things to talk about, but don't go away. I'm Bill Cooper.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back to Wild at Heart, your source of information in the Ozarks and a few points beyond. This segment is brought to you by Guard Trucking Equipment and the Outdoor Superstore, your Husqvarna dealer located on the North Idle Road in St. James, and the Missouri Trappers Association, dedicated to preserving the heritage and skills of trapping. Well, Jerry Boy, we've got a pile of subjects to talk about here, and everybody's getting excited, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, the bow shops are extremely busy. We had the 4J Archery crew on the show just a couple of weeks ago, and they've been busy all summer, you know, with the great shoots they have. It flabbergasts me how many people show up with these $1,000 bows, man.
Yeah.
All the equipment on them, shoot, these guys are good. In fact, we saw Janet Jenkins the other night down at the Grace Church for the mm-hmm. big outdoor event that they had going on, and she placed in the archery competition.
And, you know, I was amazed at some of the price of some of those bows down there, quite honestly.
Oh, man, I tell you what, it's not like the day when we were shooting little fiberglass bows, you know.
No, it certainly is not. And made our own arrows and
did all of those sorts
yeah,
of things.
Yeah.
And yeah, we were pretty innovative, I think. In fact, I used to make my own slingshots, John. In fact, I got in trouble one time for stealing my little buddy's inner tube out of his bicycle, because that's what we made. That's what we made the bands for out of on our slingshots.
Of course, yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah.
So tell me about some of these bows you saw.
Oh,
the
gee.
Bows we saw. Wow, you know what a compound bow is?
Oh, yeah.
With the wheels and cables and
right.
all this sort of thing, come in any kind of camouflage pattern you want. And of course, we're talking Matthews, the gentleman that was doing the show, was actually the brother.
Yeah, Randy McPherson, who we had on that previous Wednesday.
Right, that's right. And Randy's the brother of the gentleman that started Matthews Bow. And you remember, John, right here in the studio, I recall I do recall some things, Jerry. I recall the company called McPherson and quizzed him about it on air, and he said, that was my brother's company as well. He used his last name for the McPherson line. He started a new line, which is the most popular line in the world, twice the size of the next company selling bows. And he used his first name, Matthews. I mean, boy, you got to hand it to him, you know.
He did good marketing.
Yeah, absolutely, and rather simple, you know, but worked extremely well for them. But, he gave away just a crossbow there that evening that was worth $1,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. You're talking high-dollar equipment. Now, do you have to have that real expensive equipment? No, not necessarily to kill a deer, but the accuracy factor goes up considerably. It's like anything else. You get what you pay for. But all the attachments, now you may spend easily $800 to $1,200 on just the bow alone, and then you're looking at putting attachments on that thing, your arrows, your quivers, and
your sights, and on and on.
And you can shoot an arrow these days, John, and you want to hit what you're shooting at, because you miss, you just watch $30 fly away.
$30, wow.
Yes, in an arrow shaft and these good broadheads these days, yeah. That's why these guys have the very high dollar accurate bows, just so they don't lose arrows.
Right.
But yeah, you said you get what you pay for. That rings true in bows and firearms and fly rods and spinning rods even.
And everything is so high tech. You know, we talk about our grandkids being able to use the computers and all the little iPads and that sort of thing. Well, a lot of them know the technology behind this outdoor equipment as well, people that are really into it. And it's so interesting to watch the young crowd down at Grace Church this last Saturday night. You can see all these young buff guys walking around.
Yeah.
You know, it made me wonder what they had those bows cranked up to. You know, I used to shoot. I know some of them are shooting 70 pounds. That will kill an elephant.
You know? Oh, yes. Yeah.
I can remember shooting recurves that were 35 and 40 pounds and kill deer with them. But, of course, I was shooting at 15 or 20 yards, had the old bare broadheads sharpened on a whetstone, sharpened enough I could shave with it, you know. And the point is, you know, you want to make a good, clean kill. But they're doing that today with broadheads that are 15, 18 bucks a piece.
So how far can someone who's a good archer shoot?
Wow.
Accurately.
Now, controversial topic.
Yeah, very much so.
And I'm old-fashioned. Now, you put me on the spot here, John, but
okay.
I'm going to tell it like it is. We teach outdoor educators, we teach a 30 or 40-yard shot is about as far as you need to be shooting. But these bows today, I'm not kidding you, guys that practice, they can put her in a small bull's-eye at 100 yards every shot.
And still have the power to kill a deer.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. But we don't promote that at all, because not that many people are going to practice to that extent that they got the confidence to kill a deer at 100 yards.
A moving target, especially, yeah.
Well, most of them are not at a particularly at 100 yards, they're not going to shoot while they're moving. They're going to make sure they're standing still and not even acting nervous, because if you've got a nervous deer on your hand, man, he can, you know, flinch or make a move in a hurry that's going to wind up being a wounded animal, and we won't prevent that all we can. And any of us, you know, that discussion a lot of times people don't want to talk about. I've gotten trouble a time or two with anti-hunters talking about that very topic, either online or in articles or whatever, but we all as hunters need to make good, clean, ethical kills. So you develop a range that works for you and that you've got confidence in knowing that you can put that animal down with one good, clean shot. But you always have the element, you know, that they want that deer so badly that they try to stretch their limits and they wind up either wounding an animal or wasting arrows or whatever. So it's a tough topic to discuss, but we really encourage people to do the right thing, because we have a tremendous resource here in the state of Missouri. We still have lots of deer, although populations are down a little bit in some areas, but sometimes people use that as an excuse. We got lots of them, so what if I send one of them running off with an arrow stuck in his rear end or something, you know. Some people do have that attitude, but I don't think it's very prevalent. If you watch, for instance, Jerry, the guys that were there Saturday night, I don't think any of those guys would do that sort of thing, and I would hate to be around for one of them to see me do that.
Absolutely.
Take an unethical shot. I think you would hear about it. Because bow hunters are quite a lot like your fly fishermen, Jerry. They're a concerted group that is concerned about the resource itself, and they're concerned about methods. And these guys will argue to the hilt sometimes about new methods that come up. And one of those have been crossbows.
Right, exactly.
That have come on the scene. But I'm old enough, I remember when everybody had to hunt with a recurve, and when the compounds came on the scene, oh my goodness, you thought World War III was going to start.
Absolutely. That was verboten, so to speak. That just was not ethical.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people preached that that was not ethical because of the mechanics of the thing. And
the velocities. And
oh, yeah. People just swore we would decimate the deer herd, and the overall kill went up only a percentage point or two. Then just a few years ago, the crossbows came on the scene. And some states have had crossbow seasons for 30 years now. And I remember being in some hot and heated discussions. I used to hate crossbows, too, because I thought the same thing. Man, you know, they can pick them up and just in a few minutes be pretty accurate with them. So you think in your way of reasoning that, boy, people are going to kill deer like crazy. But, you know, I injured an arm and couldn't pull a compound back anymore and had to go to a crossbow. And I hated it because it's heavy and awkward. And boy, it's just tough to hunt with, particularly out of a stand. But the average bow hunter drops out at age 49. Pretty young, and that's because of shoulder, wrist, elbow problems. And, of course, the manufacturers jumped all over the thing when states started legalizing crossbows, and I would too, you know, if I was a manufacturer. Sure. It's another way to make revenue. But I remember a particular, boy, it was a hot and heated battle here in the state of Missouri because some of the bow hunting organizations came out hot and heavy against crossbows. And, you know, emotions just personal thoughts and ideas came into play, and it was the same thing. It was the same fight that took place between the recurve and the compound hunters. Same statements used. They'll decimate the deer herd. Mm-hmm. Well, I had to write an article about it, you know, and boy, did I get my ears burned over that one. But I had my ducks in a row. I got the statistic from Ohio and Kentucky and Tennessee and some of the states that had crossbow seasons for 30 years. They had the statistics. Lo and behold, the kill ratio for compounds and crossbows was exactly the same, 15%. And now that we've legalized crossbows, the thing it's done is taken hunters my age, who usually drop out at 49, and I was in my mid-50s when I had problems, but I'd be done if it wasn't for the crossbow. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the guys that have. So you're keeping people in the sport longer, which is a good thing. We've got the resources, and we know our departments need the money as well. People like to argue and fight about that too, but another subject for another day. And another thing it's done, it's brought lots of women and girls into the sport, and they have been the largest growing populace in the last 20 years in bow hunting, as well as the shooting and hunting sport.
Yeah, exactly, and the same goes for fly fishing as well. But, you know, this may be changing the subject a little bit, but you were talking about the distance that you can shoot. Got a lot of customers who live out in Montana, Idaho, and those areas, and their biggest complaint, because they fish in the summer, hunt in the winter, biggest complaint is hunters coming out there and trying to take these 500, 600, 700, 800, you know, long-range shots, and as they're saying, they don't feel it's ethical, and I would have to be on that side of the argument. I think that you should, in order to keep from wounding an animal, get close enough to it. And this is just my personal opinion, but taking those long shots with a rifle is not hunting.
Well, you've got to, again, it comes down to some personal choices, but you've got to train yourself and be equipped for that.
Exactly.
Hey, we need to take the break here again, folks, for listening to some of our advertisers, but this is Wild at Heart with Bill Cooper and Jerry Cook, and we'll be right back.
Now, back to Wild at Heart with the latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond on ESPN 107.3.
Welcome back. I'm Bill Cooper, and you're listening to Wild at Heart. This segment of our show is brought to you by Salty Jack's Bar and Grill in Eminence, located on the crystal clear Jack's Fork River, and by State Farm Insurance Agent Michelle Beckett in Sullivan, helping life go right. Boy, Jerry, I tell you what, my life's going right when I'm hunting or fishing, man.
Anytime you're on the river in the field, it's going right.
It really is. And I just get so excited this time of year, and I know there's tens of thousands of other Missouri outdoorsmen that get the same way because so many things happen at once and happen so fast. And, boy, I like to do them all.
Well, and you know, dove season will be here very soon.
September 1.
Yep, September 1, what, a week and a half away?
Yeah, and boy, if you hadn't been out on a clay range or throwing some targets, you know, clay targets in the backyard with that old orange slinger, you know, somebody always winds up getting hit in the head, you know, when we're throwing those clay targets. But it takes a few minutes to get onto that, too, you know. It's kind of like the golf swing, you know. You got to get it just right or things don't go well.
Don't go well at all, no.
But dove season, man, is such an exciting thing. And thousands and thousands and thousands will people will come out on opening day, and it's on a Saturday this year, so it's going to be huge. And, you know, they're starting to cut a few crops. I've noticed in southwest Missouri going toward the lease over there, a lot of that corn is just about ready. They planted a good 3 weeks earlier over there than did in this part of the world, so they're going to be cutting some corn real soon. And, boy, that means doves are going to start flocking in there. And just, it's a social sport.
It is, and you know, the doves love the corn, and the hunters love the dove hunting and love to socialize. And I think there's more more socializing going on sometimes than there is hunting.
Well, if you call laughing at each other socializing,
exactly.
And I've been in some places where a little money changed hands too.
Yeah. I've seen that happen before as well.
Yeah, and, you're setting yourself up for a loss if you're betting on a dove hunt because you're going to miss a lot of them. And I've seen guys, you know, that I've seen guys knock limits down with, you know, X number of shots, the same number of shots, I should say. But that doesn't happen very often. The national average is only like one bird for five shots.
Yeah, I don't know what the national average is, but, you know, you were talking about the cornfields. Down where you grew up, I know over where I grew up, sorghum fields were really popular fields to hunt dove over.
We did have some sorghum fields. I never hunted one, but I heard guys talk about it. Primarily ours was soybeans and corn and wheat. Now, if you could find a wheat stubble field, particularly if it had been burned off a week or two ahead of time, because doves have such weak feet, they don't really scratch. They need seeds on top of the soil. And, boy, if you've got a burned wheat field, Conservation Department does that with some of its dove fields. And, boy, those are hot spots because every dove in the county will come to those things. And, of course, I can remember we had so many doves in Boot Hill when I was a kid after school, about 30 of us boys sometimes would get out in a 1,000-acre field and just pass shooting.
You didn't see sorghum fields down where you grew up because you were on the wrong side of the Mississippi.
Well, that's all a matter of opinion. But, we start a real argument there. You probably killed doves in tobacco fields. Smoking wacky weed or something.
Yeah, right.
But speaking of weeds, you know, annual plants, weeds, we call them the pigweed, the arum.
Right.
Put out lots of tiny seeds. There was a little plant that we used to just hate it. It was so tough, real woody at the base, wasn't real big, only grew about 18 inches, called tea weed. Put out a tiny little black seed, but those capsules would explode and just send those seeds in all directions. Boy, you could find a few of those plants out in a field, usually soybean fields, even between the rows. The doves had some method of locating those things. That was a hot spot to sit on.
I think the doves like anything that produces small seeds like that, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Sunflower is one of their absolute favorites. And down in the Boot Hill, you get over in the sandy soil, melon fields. One of the best dove hunts I ever had in my life was just a dried-up melon field. And then we got to walking around stomping on a few melons that were left because you broke those things open. Still a little bit of water in them. The doves would actually come in just to water. in those split melons. Mm-hmm. But, boy, we burn up a lot of shells sitting around a melon field, you know. Besides that, you find a good watermelon's good to eat once in a while, too. Most of them are dried up, but hey, we'd check a lot of them, you know. Axe and get a little slow. You'd cut a watermelon open, sit back in your lawn chair under the shade tree and eat watermelon.
And we all know that some of the best watermelon comes from down in that part of the country.
Absolutely. Boot Hill's famous for a number of things. Peaches, watermelons, good dove and duck hunting.
Did you ever figure how much each one of those doves ended up costing you?
No, I was afraid to do that, man. My wife would never let me go again. She knew how much a family budget I spent on shells for dove hunting. But dove hunting's not the only thing that's happening. Just a few days after that, I think the 9th, the teal season coming in, the blue-winged teal. And I got a hold to one of the area biologists recently, and he runs the rivers and stuff a lot. I asked him if he'd seen any teal yet. No, I hadn't seen any yet, but he promised to call me as soon as he started seeing them. So I got eyes on the sky out there.
Yeah.
Will help out a lot because I love to teal hunt, man. I just go to a small lake, sit up in a boat with my dog, throw a few decoys out. But those rascals, man, they're famous for flying before sunrise. And of course with teal you have to wait, and this is important. People get in trouble every year because, you know, in regular duck season you can shoot 30 minutes prior to sunrise.
Right.
Teal season, because it's only duck species in season, they want you to be absolutely certain you're identifying these birds, so you have to wait the sun up. Now the vast majority of teal that I always see come in 20 minutes before shooting hours, light right in the decoys, you know, and then the dog goes nuts because they're 10 feet from him, and he's wanting to get out of the boat and get them, you know. And so sometimes it's a battle with young dogs to get them to stay still, but that's when I get them right by my side and hold on to one of his ears, you know. But I've got a video. Well, on my website, the introductory video opens with a scene of, I don't know, 75, 100 teal coming in with that sun, big ball of a sun coming up in the eastern sky, and it's all blue and purple. Just a gorgeous, one of my favorite outdoor scenes of all time.
Beautiful, yeah.
And your website is?
It's aoutdoorstv.com.
Okay.
Yeah. You can pick that up. I don't use the website a lot, but you can find the same thing on the Facebook page. It's Outside Again. Facebook Outside Again Always, I think.
Okay.
But, you can pick those things up. But lots of tips and tactics we put on the Facebook site. And occasionally the website, I put the new videos up on it. But, it's worth a check out just to see that scene, John. Yeah, you may not want to read any of the rest of it, but but I repeat a lot of stuff on the Facebook site, you know, friends that have got outdoor businesses as well, or see something that's really interesting, I duplicate it on my Facebook page. And lots of good information there. A lot of fun just to keep it up. I post something almost every day. But, Jerry, gigging season coming up to the 15th of September. Lots of people in the Ozarks. And a lot of time you meet people from outside the Ozarks, they don't really understand what that's all about. But I'm telling you talk about a ton of fun. Get a few guys out on a boat, particularly on a really cold night. It's the old-timers say it makes the water more clear and you see the fish better, you know. But suckers, yeah, they're bottom feeders, and people going, yuck, you know, that don't sound so hot. Well, you got to try it first. If you'll get out on one of these trips with these guys and they gig those fish, and they'll tell you they do taste a lot better if you cook them right there on the riverbank.
On the gravel bar right there.
You bet. I think it has something to do with the atmosphere, too, you know.
You know, I've already been noticing people out working on their gigging boats and rigs, and they're starting to prepare for the season.
Oh, absolutely. They're sharpening those gigs, getting new gigs, making sure the boat motor's in good shape.
Yep.
Well, that really stinks when you're way down the river and your motor gives up. I had one blow up one time. And, man, it was a long push back up the river.
That's long paddle back.
Glad we had enough gigs in the boat for everybody to have one. We really dulled those gigs pushing in the gravel, you know, back a mile or so back up to the ramp. But we made it. That was the important thing for sure. But, boy, other things are coming up. You know, the bow season starts September 15th as well. Big excitement. And, golly, we hardly even have time to touch on that. But another thing I love to do, Jerry, in the fall is float our Ozark stream when the colors hit.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous. And I just heard from Brandon Butler, going to have several of us down to his cabin on Sinking Creek over his Labor Day weekend. And we're actually going to float part of the current river, and I get to float my good buddy Ron Kruger, who passed away last year, his bright red canoe. Really looking forward to doing that. And I'm actually going to cook a couple gravel bar gourmets on the river bank for these guys. Well, man, what a fun show today. Jared, things have passed by. Time flies when we get on this show, you know?
It goes by in a hurry.
Oh, well, it's always so much fun to have our guests and everything. But Wild at Heart is heard every Wednesday afternoon from 4 to 6 with a repeat Sunday morning from 8 to 10. The show is produced in the studios of ESPN 107.3 in Rolla and engineered by the great John Francis. We'd like to thank our guests today. That was Jack Uxa, Jim Traylor. Tommy Bench wasn't able to be with us because of a medical emergency. And, of course, always Ray I. Ray comes to us each week from Eye on the Outdoors on 590 The Fan. And don't forget, you can always listen to a podcast of this show. Just go to our website at ESPN1073.com, click Programming, and Wild at Heart. I'm Bill Cooper. For Jerry Cook and John Francis, we thank you for listening to Wild at Heart. We'll see you next week on the radio.
Wild at Heart on ESPN 107.3. Powered by Cowtown USA, Colden Steakhouse and Grill, J. Cook Fly Rods, The Outdoor Superstore, Shady Lanes Cabins and Motel, Advanced Performance Shooting, Missouri Trappers Association, Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, and State Farm Agent Michelle Beckett. The latest in outdoor recreation from the Ozarks and points beyond. Wild at Heart, 4 p.m. Wednesdays and 8 a.m. on Sundays on ESPN 107.3.